good intention.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. Sarah McLachlan, Witness. Great song. Just had to throw it in there real quick. Are we getting it? I don't know. Second hour of X Squared Radio. Please join us tonight. 415-762-1161. We were talking about Vimanas in our last hour. And one of the fascinating things about this discovery, and I'm just going to call it a rediscovery. As I was mentioning at the end of the last hour, mankind had once again in 1969 reached into space for peaceful reasons. The only excursions into space known before this time were in stories about the Vimanas, the world's oldest texts in the Vedic texts that describe these air and space traveling ships. And as in modern times, the race to space was driven by the desire for more advanced weapon systems. That's what fuels our race today. That's why NASA ran out of money with the X-37B and the Air Force took it over with its unlimited supply of money. and the ability to hide those budgets from Congress and from the taxpayers. So that's the mystery. What in the world is it doing up there? But one thing is for sure, with discussions of conventional weapons that can be dropped in less than 60 minutes anywhere on the planet, and laser weaponry, and even high-tech surveillance weaponry, and no humans aboard to change the mind of what's going on the aircraft. These are robots controlled by people on Earth. So twice removed helps us, it allows us to dehumanize the mechanism of war. $1.3 trillion defense budget and a mere $100 billion space budget over a period of time. That's the whole Constellation program. So what do you think? Do you think that the race of mankind has been able to fly before? Has he been able to mount wings to space only to be caught up in his quest for global dominion and soon thereafter dashed to the ground by his lust for power? You know, looking at the Mayan craft, it's very interesting, the structures of this, and it's a tiny, but it is a metal replica. The structures just in front of the tail, strongly reminiscent of ailerons or elevons, like an elevator and ailerons that help turn the aircraft like a modern jet. With a slightly forward curve, they are attached to the fuselage rather than the wings. In any case, they look more like airplane parts than the claspers of a fish. It doesn't look like a fish at all. It doesn't look like a flying fish. If the two prominent spirals on the wings are supposed to be a stylized version of the eyes of a ray, then the two globular objects positioned on the head of the craft, what are they supposed to represent? To complicate the identification even more, the spirals on the wings have their copies positioned on the nose of the object in the opposite direction. When the object is viewed in profile, the dissimilarity to anything from the animal kingdom is even more pronounced. It isn't a fish. It isn't a bird. If the zoomorphic explanation is supposed to hold, then why did the artist cut the head off almost three quarters from the body? And why is the nose practically rectangular with the cut tilted forward, with the eyes positioned at either side, when fish eyes are usually more near the center of the body line and far forward of the head? Well, the interesting thing about this, if we're just going to call it a craft, is that the Germans used this design exactly. One of them flew perfectly without any modifications. You know, when all the features are taken into account, the object does not look like the representation of any known animal at all, but it does look astonishingly like an airplane. The photos and the outlines of this are incredibly well proportioned. Several engineers, one of them was Arthur Young, a designer of the Bell helicopters and other aircraft. His analysis confirmed that the object contained many features which would fit the airplane hypothesis, but there were several ones that did not fit in that scenario. Wings do seem to be in the wrong place. They should be further forward so that their one-quarter chord coincides with the center of gravity. The nose is not like anything on airplanes as well, so while the object is suggesting an airplane, some features would not seem to support this hypothesis. But let's entertain several possibilities. If we imagine that the separation after the windshield is not a cockpit, and that the pilot and the cargo were located somewhere in the main fuselage, let's say, then we can envision the nose as something else. Let's assume that the nose is actually a jet. If the machine needs to slow down, the jet flow directed against the path of the flight would obviously act just like an air brake. But how to redirect the jet now in the opposite direction? If we envision the nose as a movable part of the plane, turning around the point located where the nose and fuselage meet, thus pivoting the nose downward to tuck it under the fuselage, that would enable the desired effect. You'd almost have a VTOL. You'd have vertical takeoff and landing. What's more, it will readjust the center of gravity, and the wings would be just the right place for high-powered flight. Another problem, though, will appear, and that is the drag, which would be created by the back of the nose now positioned in the front. But that can be attributed to artistic license. That seems to be the case because several other similar planes feature the back part of the nose tilted more forward, so the angle of the back of the nose when pivoted is more corresponding to aerodynamic principles. The interesting thing is that the darn thing's 1,000 years old, so it appears that someone in the Mayan age either was able to fly, knew someone who was able to fly, or had one heck of an imagination, or had a vision of what planes look like in the future. But to realize that this particular craft, this particular artifact, wasn't found in an engineer's laboratory. It was found in the general population of things, a lot like a child's toy would be. Now, if we found the model of a stealth fighter 1,000 years from now, you know, regular old Revell comics, Revell models, a model plane, we would not say that that was an engineer's design. We would say that's a child's toy, so common that it would be in the possession of a child. Now, what we know about ancient Indian flying machines comes from, of course, the ancient Indian sources, India from India, written texts that have come down to us through the centuries. There's no doubt that most of these texts are authentic. Many are well known, ancient Indian epics themselves, and there are literally hundreds of them. Most of them have not even been translated into English yet from the old Sanskrit. The Indian emperor Ashoka started a secret society of the 9 unknown men, great Indian scientists who were supposed to catalog the many sciences. Ashoka kept their work secret because he was afraid that the advanced science cataloged by these men, culled from ancient Indian sources, would be used for the evil purpose of, you guessed it, war, which Ashoka was strongly against, having been converted to Buddhism after defeating a rival army in a bloody battle. The 9 unknown men wrote a total of 9 books, presumably one each. One of the books was The Secrets of Gravitation. This book, known to historians but not actually seen by them, dealt chiefly with gravity control. It is presumably still around somewhere, kept in a secret library in India, Tibet, or elsewhere, perhaps even in North America somewhere. One can certainly understand Ashoka's reasoning for wanting to keep such knowledge a secret, assuming it exists. If the Nazis, for instance, had weapons like this at their disposal during World War II, Ashoka was also aware devastating wars using such advanced vehicles and other futuristic weapons that had destroyed the ancient Indian Rama Empire several thousand years before. Only a few years ago, the Chinese discovered some Sanskrit documents in Lhasa, Tibet. That's the capital city of Tibet. It's at 11,500 feet. The oldest and used to be the tallest building in the world is the Patala. And they sent these documents to the University of Chandragarh to be translated. Dr. Ruth Reina of the university said recently that the documents contain directions for building interstellar spaceships. Their method of propulsion, she said, was anti-gravitational and was based upon a system analogous to that of Lagima, the unknown power of the ego, existing in man's psychological makeup, a centrifugal force strong enough to counteract all gravitational pull, according to Hindu yogis. It is this Lagima which enables a person to levitate. Dr. Reina said that on board these machines, which were called astras by the text, the ancient Indians could have sent a detachment of men onto any planet, according to the document, which is thought to be thousands of years old. The manuscripts were also said to reveal the secret of Antima, the cap of invisibility, and Garima, how to become as heavy as a mountain of lead. Naturally, Indian scientists did not take the text very seriously, but then became more positive about the value of them when the Chinese announced that they were including certain parts of the data for study in their space program. This was one of the first instances of a government admitting to researching anti-gravity. And by the way, most of the claims that have been made in anti-gravity have come from China. You know, mankind stepped down off the horse, from what we recall, in the first time in the mid-1800s, and didn't learn to fly again until the early 1900s, after Orville and Wilbur Wright learned to make coordinated turns in heavier-than-air flight. By the way, within 6 years, we were engaged in the war to end all wars, or so we thought. My question to you this hour, and you can join us, and we're going to get deep into discussion here if we can, 415-762-1161, anywhere on planet or off planet, 415-762-1161. My question to you, can man return to space without the desire for dominion over the Earth and even over space itself? Do you think that the leaders of the world today are still so possessive of their lands and gold that they must defend them against visitors from the stars? There's only one force in the world that can determine that, and that's you. I hesitate to even call you a force. You are a population of people like the world has likely never known. Maybe there were advanced civilizations in times past. Maybe they learned to live with the resources of the planet the way we have. Maybe there were billions of them. Humans, advanced, intelligent, loving, artistic, creative, aggressive, desirous, living on the Earth. And maybe they, too, could not get along. Civilization against civilization, community against community, national pride against national pride, religion against religion. And maybe they wiped each other out. So here we are again, one would say. Here we are again, alive and intelligent and full of passion and full of dreams about the future. And we stand toes over the edge of the precipice, looking into the blackness of extinction. We, the people of Earth, we Americans, Mexicans, Canadians, Chinese, Indians, Russians, Pakistanis, Jews and Arabs, all of us, breathing the same air, drinking the same water, having the same babies, loving the same women and men. And yet, we have crosshairs on each other. We have prejudices and judgments against each other. And we seek to drive each other into extinction. Why? Why are we doing that? You're intelligent. You're gracious. And you're patient. You are able to love with a power and influence that is felt across the universe. And yet you are afraid. Why? Ramon from New York, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm so glad you're talking about this today, because a couple days, actually, I got into a heated what started off as a debate and ended up turning into an argument, and the person ended up calling me stupid. But actually, we were discussing the same thing that you are discussing today.
And which side of the which side of the argument were you on?
Well, I listen to the show and I go to East City. What do you think?
Okay, I would say that you're on the intelligent side, the open-minded side of the argument. That's what I would say.
Well, the funny thing is that I guess it's all what you believe, because the person I was arguing with considers himself a very open-minded person. But the argument started with the famous Dogon tribe, which, for those of you who are not familiar with the Dogon tribe, they're famous for knowing the elliptical, what was the name of the star? Sirius, is it?
Yeah.
Sirius A?
Right, Sirius B, actually.
Yeah, and them knowing about its elliptical, what's it called?
The elliptical orbit, but Sirius is actually a binary star with our sun. The thing that really amazes me about the Dogon tribes is that they number Earth as planet number 6, not planet number 3, because they count from the outside in, which is kind of amazing, since we didn't really profess Pluto until the 20th century.
Well, that's how the argument started. I was referring to all the ancient civilizations that talk about this ancient knowledge, and he just said it was just lucky guesses, that's not a lucky guess, and that's not a belief system. There's no way that you're just going to guess, okay, that star there has another star that you can't see that was not discovered till the 1940s or 50s, and you're going to sit there and tell me that that was a lucky guess, that it knew it's actual elliptical orbit, and they celebrate it, the Dogon tribe celebrates it every 50 years, and they mimic it going around. That's a lucky guess?
It doesn't sound like a lucky guess to me. By the way, Earth Explorers, Sirius B is a white dwarf, which is behind the Sirius star that you see. It doesn't put out much light, not much at all. In fact, you can't really see it unless you have a very, very good telescope. So to be able to attribute a lucky guess to an ancient tribe, by the way, the Dogon thinks that they are people of the stars. They may have very well been introduced to the stars, and maybe they did come from the stars and just forgot or just decided to get casual. I don't know. But one thing's for sure, they were dead accurate about the elliptical orbit of Sirius B.
Yet, with something that to me is proof positive. If you take that in a court of law, it's proven. You know, if they were trying to prove someone guilty, they would have been found guilty just on that alone.
Right.
So how would you know?
Well, at least of being great astronomers. And so how did the argument progress from here? Once you made your case, they said, oh, yeah, what about this?
Well, what I said was there's only two things that I can attribute to. One was either being told by somebody off-world, or B, they were remote viewers, which we know a lot of the ancient mystics are remote viewers. It's not something new. And he said, oh, that's just hooey. And I said, well, if it's hooey, then why would the CIA create a program called Stargate and use it? And why would the KGB use it, and the English intelligence and the Chinese intelligence to this day, if it's just hooey? Actually, you can go online and look up scientific papers on it. Oh, that's just a belief system.
That's very true. I mean, remote viewing is definitely at least a mathematical science. We've had several guests on this program that have talked about government programs of which they have been a part in training those that have a propensity for remote viewing. And when you get several remote viewers together, the accuracy and precision of what they can see, depending on the subject matter, is very high, like 80 or 90%, which is statistically significant.
I think you said something like 95%.
Well, that's pretty incredible. I don't know why they're not winning all the lottery numbers, but as I said, it has a lot of it has to do with specific information too. It's not focused on one single science. Some people are very good at finding lost children, and some people are very good at finding hidden nuclear weapons. But the idea that you can have no secrets against or from a group of remote viewers who are well-trained.
Well, my point that I want to make is that if you're not willing to look in the mirror, as you were saying, as far as us progressing and becoming interstellar, if you're not willing to look in the mirror, and no matter how many mirrors I put around you, you just don't open your eyes to look, you're not going to progress. You're not going to see the true self of your... You're not going to see your true self. So...
Well, what I'm asking people to do is not... I mean, they're looking. All you have to do is turn on a laptop and hook to the internet, and you'll see. You know, go to a conference, and you'll really have your eyes opened. But once you see, I'm asking people to speak. I'm asking them to pull a handle, run for office, do something. Don't go through life as a spectator.
Yeah.
You know, you and I, we can't do this by ourselves, but we could do it with a couple of billion people behind us or with us in one unified voice. I mean, look how popular global warming got. The call, the clarion call was, you know, right at the threshold of being earth-changing. And somehow the disinformation artists were able to craft something that convinced the general populace, oh, there's no such thing as global warming. It's all a big cycle. Man has no effect whatsoever on the climate. We don't have to watch what we're doing at all. And it's beginning to lose steam.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a shame. As far as creating new technologies and becoming interstellar. There's been, I haven't met any personally, but there's been many rumors of people who have created these technologies and just get hit upside, you know, either their family's threatened or they buy them out and say, hey, I'm going to give you so much money, keep quiet.
I have heard that too, and I, you know, to this day, I really don't know what to make of it. I can tell you that as an engineer of the new paradigm myself, one of many, I have not experienced any of that. I was, in fact, reading a portfolio of an investment banker just the other day. And he cited as the number one obstacle for new technologies, new businesses, startups to coming to fruition, just getting into business. And that obstacle was access to capital. That is the number one obstacle. There is no need whatsoever to send men in black or to do anything except just sit back and let the inventor starve. And that's pretty much what's being done out here.
Yeah. Well, how can... the question next would be is, for those of us who are not inventors, how do we help?
Ah, that's a great question. I have the answer. I have the answer. I know the answer to this question. Here's how to do it. We know that the way the government works, or shall we say, not the government, but the people who are in charge. I don't really think we have a government. I think we have a loose coalition of bureaucracies. But let's just assume for a moment that there's somebody behind, for instance, the Air Force's use of the X-37B as a launch vehicle for this mysterious weapons technology that they have. Untold amounts of money were spent. We will never have a full accounting on it, I'm sure. How they do it is they are able to write checks based upon tiny bits amount of money taken from every single American, and maybe other countries as well. Well, that's the amount that's involuntarily taken from your paycheck each month, or each paycheck. What Americans need to do is they need to find a technology that they want to promote, like it could be electric cars, it could be water filtration technology, it could be solar power, wind power, any number of innovative technologies that are out there. And they could voluntarily take part of their paycheck and give it each month to those technologies. Can you imagine if 200 million Americans took a dollar a month, and focused it on one technology? Like, say, bringing affordable electric vehicles to the average person, or creating affordable solar technology for homes. $1 a month, $200 million a month. That's $2.4 billion a year that could go to this kind of technology. And the government would have no control over it at all, because it's all voluntary dollars that go into stuff. That's the kind of power the people have. That's the kind of focused energy that it takes to change a planet. And what's a dollar a month? That's less than parking fare a month.
It's less than Starbucks coffee.
Yeah, exactly. Less than McDonald's coffee, which I think is better than Starbucks, but that's neither here nor there.
There was one person I wanted to, let's get his name wrong. Stephen Greer,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Stephen Greer, right. Dr. Stephen Greer.
Yes. I actually sent him a letter and told him I would, you know, take myself down to Virginia and, you know, clean the space for free and just to be around the stuff and help them in any way I can, and told him what I was capable of doing. And he was like, well, we don't need people at this moment. Not complaining, just saying that as far as on my point of view, I'm putting myself out there. So if anybody needs an extra set of hands, I'm not an engineer, but, you know, even just turn this here, turn that there.
I know exactly what you mean. I do the same thing. We'll work for food. Yes, I understand. And that is certainly contributory. No question about it. And I will keep you in mind, Ramon, because we have things going on here. And by the way, they're not classified. So anything that we're doing, if you want to find out more about it, you can always go to the website, check it out. If you have questions, you can email me. Ramon will attest that if you email me, I will write you back. I don't care how many emails I get. It will take some time, but I will write you back. They don't go into a round file. I care about each and every one of you, and I will answer you back.
All right, Dr. Agnes, I'll let another caller get on, and thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Ramon. Have a wonderful week.
You too.
So, Earth Explorers, I put the question to you again, that we as a people, as a race of human beings, we are all genetically very close to one another. Mentally, we are spread out. Socially, we are spread out. Certainly, religiously, we are spread out. But we can focus as a people. When you go out into space and you turn around and you look back at Earth, you realize that it's a very small, special, rare planet in a zone not too far from the sun, not too close to the sun, just right. for life. This is the life zone, the Goldilocks zone around any star. No matter how big or small, there is a zone at which water will remain liquid. And the other planets, I'm afraid the occupants are resigned to live inside the planet, where conditions can be more closely controlled. I don't think it's too bizarre. Not too bizarre. Keep in mind, people of the civilized world spend less than 15% of their time outdoors. Some even less than that. In the more inhospitable areas, Houston or Alaska or areas like that, people spend much more time than that inside than outside. They live in some of the most beautiful, picturesque areas on the planet, and yet at 100 below zero or 100 above zero, it isn't very comfortable for human beings, so we have a tendency to stay inside. And for most planets that have perhaps 1/100th the density of our atmosphere on the surface of the planet, might be quite hospitable on the inside of the planet some distance, where it might be 80 below zero on the outside, it might be a nice, balmy 55 degrees Fahrenheit on the inside of the planet. Nevertheless, those peoples eventually have to learn to live as a planet. You know, it's a cold, dark space between here and the next place, and as my good friend Kevin Smith would say, good planets are hard to come by. So we really don't have another frontier here. There was a time when the population of Earth was sparse, and when kings became tyrants and armies became oppressive, we simply sold everything and moved west to the wilderness. Well, the wilderness is gone now on planet Earth, unless you want to live at sea, or you want to live on the peak of a mountain, or in the middle of an inhospitable desert, or you want to live on one of the polar ice caps. There are still frontiers, but I dare say you're not going to get high-speed internet. And there's no Walmart locally. So, the frontiers being gone, the requirement, almost requirement, on this planet to live on a grid of some kind, either piped water or wired electricity. Most people in the civilized world live on some kind of grid. In fact, to get off the grid, to generate enough electricity to take care of all the needs of and wants of the average household, you're talking substantial expense. In fact, you're probably talking 5, 8, even 10 years worth of utilities paid in advance to get yourself off grid and still have the convenience of, 6 or 7 kilowatts of power for your house, clean water, air conditioning, lights at night, things like that. It will take you $25,000 or $30,000 to put that kind of energy source together. Is it doable? Of course it's doable. Is it doable by the average person? No. Not unless you're willing to mortgage a house with a second mortgage or a third mortgage, or sell some of the stuff you have in order to buy solar cells or a wind generator or a hydroelectric generator if you're lucky enough to have a river or a creek next to your house. I do know people who have the ability and enough property to move water from high ground to low ground, spinning a magnetic turbine and making their own electricity. Now, it's a small amount of electricity. It's only enough for lighting. Other things like a washer and a dryer and those kinds of things have to be sacrificed. It's a small amount of electricity, and you still have to store it somehow and monitor it and go out and clean the mud out of the turbine every now and then. There's a lot of maintenance to it. It's not a simple procedure of paying a $200 or $300 or $400 light bill a month and having it come through wires under the ground through a meter into your house. But, and some would say that there's technology out there that can make the jump, that can be affordable for most people to get off grid. But be that as it may, we are a people resigned to live within societies. We desire largely to live within societies, even if they're isolated among themselves, even if our way of life, quote unquote, is different than the rest of the world's. We choose a place to live. We choose an isolation. We choose an economic system that works like a commune. I use that word very definitely, not communism, but a commune where the people of that community all work toward a common goal. And there is no real pay, per se. You don't take home a paycheck, but you do get a home and you get clothes and food. And, of course, you have to work for the greater whole. Does it work on large scales? I don't think so. Haven't seen it work yet. Because you fall on that old 80-20 rule, you know? 20% of the people do 80% of the work? Right. And the other 80% of the people? Yeah, they're sitting down watching TV on your dime. It doesn't work very long. In fact, usually it's the leaders, it's the government officials, or the families of the government officials, or those who pay the government officials, or those who bribe the government officials, who are doing the sitting while you're doing the working. But small communes do have a tendency to function. They do all over the world, and they do in this country as well. Subcultures, as it were. So let's talk a little bit about it. John from Vancouver, you're on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Brooks.
How are things up there in the BC?
Well, we haven't really hit spring yet. It's weird weather. Global warming is not happening here.
Yeah, it almost didn't happen here in eastern Kentucky, for instance. We had 21 days of snow in a row. Nobody was talking about global warming down here.
Okay. I forget your original question. You were talking about the models that really look like airplanes.
Right, right. The Vimanas and also the Mayan model that was found of the little, what looks like very closely, a jet plane.
Yeah. Okay. Let's say that knowledge to fly in those types of planes existed. Let's say that's true.
Okay. I'm with you.
What that would mean is that somewhere along the line, that knowledge was forgotten.
Right, which wouldn't take much if you had a big war or a cataclysm or a natural disaster of some kind. All the people that know how to do stuff would be gone. And then those behind wouldn't even know how to fly the darn thing, so it would go back to dust.
Right. I got a slightly different take on this. I was listening to your archives, William Bueller, the astral travel guy.
Right, right.
Yeah, so I'm associating forgetting with some of the stuff that he talked about. And what really caught my attention was he used the term energy membrane. You know, when you go from one energy level to the next, there's membranes in between one from the next.
Right, sort of like a semi-permeable membrane.
Yeah, and what he was saying was that traveling through the membrane, and unless you're really skilled, really trained, you tend to forget.
Well, that's also in Christian beliefs. And I believe William and I were talking about this. It's a little like birth. You know, we come to this world, and by the time the biological transducer is able to lens the consciousness, which usually takes, 8 to 10 years for the average person, you've forgotten everything. You've started over with whatever it is your parents and your local mores are training you with. But if you're lucky enough, well, I won't say lucky enough, if you have an opportunity to join up with your previous skill sets, your higher self, or do this astral traveling where you connect up with your original library, those experiences that you have accumulated, you can make a jump and realize that you're far more capable than what a single mortal life would afford you.
Well, I know it sounds really wonderful. What I'm getting at is because of this forgettingness down through time, what it highly suggests, you know, according to this model, is that we've gone through energy membranes from lighter to denser, and that's why we've forgotten.
Well, that could be. So my question is, have some of the race gone on to higher, shall we call it, vibrational densities through another membrane, and they don't come back? So we are actually the primitives working our way up until we reach this vibrational level and go through the next membrane.
No, I'm so aware of being a primitive, and I find it really frustrating, but, you know, being frustrated doesn't really help. But I can tell you, it's really clear to me that I'm a primitive and living in ignorance. And it's not something I really want, but it's a fact.
Well, ignorance doesn't mean you're stupid. It just means you don't have the aptitude. You haven't learned yet. That's a different affliction. That's just a matter of getting access to the knowledge, and then you can retain it and do something with it. You're an intelligent being, albeit not, you know, exposed to the Library of Alexandria.
Well, thanks for that. And so the question, you know, recently for me is, if it's true that moving from one energy frequency to the next, there is a membrane, there is a barrier, and it does involve forgetting. So I guess the question is, you know, what techniques are available to move freely through different frequency levels and still be able to remember? And I guess that's what I'm getting at.
That's the key, is to remember. And I don't mean just remember the past, also, you know, remember the possibilities of the future. I recommend, and I think William and I talked about this, I recommend using some form of meditation. It sort of quiets the world down and allows the mind or the consciousness to become aware of the more subtle energies of the environment and the universe and even other dimensions, because our lives have a tendency to get a little bit too noisy, a little too cluttered to hear those subtle energies. So I recommend at least some meditation periodically.
I've been working on that myself. Also along those lines, you know, friends, family, whatever, get emotional about the relations they have with others and, you know, members of the family, or it could be people at work, that kind of thing. And especially in relation to my wife, I just say, you know, these are programs at work. Like, don't, the second you get sucked in is the second you're involved with karma one way or another. And
yep.
So there's no real point in buying into, you know, it could be a snub, it could be, you know, those kinds of things. But that's, those, to me, are like distractions, and that's what will keep you from, you know, calming yourself down and actually exploring more subtle levels.
Well, I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
Oh.
When we gain that kind of control, or at least we're aware that we have to have that kind of control and we work on it, none of us are perfect. For the average person like you and me, it's, you know, it's a daily practice, and we get better and better at it. But for people who have their finger or their thumb, as it were, on the proverbial red button, where they can simply hit line one and dial up Wars R Us and take out their anger on someone else with much more force and considerable assets of attrition. We call that war. And what I would like to see is an end to it, where, you know, I don't care who the leader is. If they stand up and say, that's it, we're going to war, let's go wipe him out, have the people just say, and I don't think so. Let's just not do that. Why don't you go over there and duke it out? But
Yeah. Leading from behind is really not a good idea. It's not very inspirational.
It isn't.
But I'll just round this off, and again, just by saying that I think the forgetting from previous technologies is because we've gone through energy membranes through our history, and it's probably, you know, kind of woven into our DNA almost, and so we've got that challenge now to remember, and it involves going through energy changes, energy membranes. So
I think
that's really
that recollection's exactly correct. I definitely concur with that.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice to have? Well, I mean, you're doing it, like to be part of a kind of a group that's aware of that and is working on that you know, just evolving techniques or awareness steps to move through that, so that we can at least have a certain number of people remembering together as a group. I think that'd be fantastic.
I think it's wonderful, especially when there's not a charismatic at the forefront of it saying "Follow me." If the trainer,
wouldn't be interested in that.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's plenty of that out there. I mean, there's
I know.
Charismatics in alphabetical order. That's one of the reasons why I came up with X Squared Radio, and I'm a little bit at odds with my producers and my trainers, my coaches, is they're trying to brand me. I mean, they're trying to brand Brooks Agnew as you know, talk radio host extraordinaire, but unlike others who are branded, and I guess I should say everybody, you know, from Sean Hannity, Limbaugh, you know, everybody begins in radio. It's their name. I mean, it's their popularity. But X Squared Radio is designed to be not that. It's designed to be the ideas well discussed and well vetted in an open and peaceful and positive way of the guest, of the scientist, of the explorer himself. I'm just a facilitator. And although, you know, people tune in to listen to X Squared Radio, my feeling is they don't tune in to listen to me. They tune in to listen to the subjects that we discuss. It's the subjects themselves that become the headline of the program. At least that's the way I hope it goes.
Let me add this. I discovered you because I was searching, and I can't remember how I found you. It's just I know it was through me searching. And so, like, as far as I'm concerned, it's partly you, because you've got experience, and you like to put it out there, and then you like to put it out there for discussion. And because it was me searching for something that I arrived listening to you, it's got this personal connection. I can say to myself, it's not, you know, bro, I don't know what your audience is, but as far as I'm concerned, it just came by just personal searching and that kind of thing, not out of a big, huge machine doing the promotion.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And so I really value listening to you, and you talk about ideas, but you put out a lot of ideas. So, you know, we have to spend time listening to it, and then you give the opportunity to respond. So So the whole thing works out really nicely, and I have a really, I feel a very personal connection to your show.
I can't tell you how much that means to me. I really appreciate that a lot.
All right, I'm getting off now.
All right, that's great. You call back anytime. We love having you on the program.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, John. Well, Earth Explorers, that puts us about 6 minutes before the top of the hour, so I want to go ahead and take a quick musical break. We'll play a little David Acton, get a drink, get something to eat, come back. We got one more hour to go. X Squared Radio will return after this. Don't go away. We need you. We love you. See you in about 4 minutes. X Squared Radio.